This is, you know, an anti-poor man's law. In other words, the rich can get through school faster than the poor because they, you know, they don't have to take time out to work. They can get special tutors, you know, all of these things. So they were protesting that. The student movement has moved now much more into a peace movement. This has been one of the more recent kinds of things that people now are very openly speaking for peace, that the real need of Vietnam is for peace. Well, the students that are arrested are arrested for speaking out for university autonomy or for speaking out against the military courts or for speaking out for peace. They have got involved in demonstrations. One of the things which they've been strongest about and which has led to the, for example, burning of an MP jeep and stoning some soldiers and that sort of thing was that Mr. Bunker, Ambassador Bunker, in an interview in the States, a question and answer kind of interview, I believe it was Issues and Answers, inferred or almost directly said that there was communist influence in the student movement. The students believed that this was an attempt on the part of Mr. Bunker to discredit the student union, the student movement, that it was an attempt to be the first movement towards greater repression of the student movement. They asked that Mr. Bunker do one of two things. Either that he give clear proof for making the statement, you know, that he show that he had real reason for making that statement, or that he withdraw the statement. Ambassador Bunker, to my knowledge, has been very quiet. He has neither given any indication that he had reasons for making the statement, or has he withdrawn the statement.
You started delving into this earlier in the discussion. These students are getting out of Khon Son, or they're getting out of you know, just police interrogation, military court scenes, and they're talking about it. They aren't afraid. They are speaking out. How can you explain that feeling right now?
I don't know. It's an interesting thing. At the meeting of the students on Saturday night, Ho Hu Tung, Representative Ho Hu Tung, who has spent about 15 years in jail himself, made somewhat the same point. He said that these prison conditions have lasted for the last 40 years. Now, suddenly, I feel encouraged that we can have improvement because there is a movement. There is a real movement against prison conditions. The reason for this, I think several things. I've talked with people in the student movement for improving conditions in the prisons. These are people who have been tortured and so on. And they say this, they say that there are thousands of our friends in prison who are being tortured. We may be sent back to prison and be tortured. The only way that we can save ourselves and our friends is to end these conditions in the prisons. That we've got to raise our voices, that we are insignificant. Some of them that I know, for example, have brothers, or in some cases husbands, close relatives or very, very close friends that are still in prison. And I know I feel after being, you know, after seeing the prison conditions, and I haven't even experienced this sort of thing, that once you walk down that aisle and look down on each side of you and you see the people in the tiger cages, or you talk with people that can't walk because they've been shackled, or because their knees have been beaten, this sort of thing. You look at it very, very differently. you know, you can't ignore it anymore. I think that too many of us, you know, that haven't taken the time, you know, just to talk to these people, and there are students and so on all over Saigon, you know, who are very willing to talk about this. It's being written every day in the Vietnamese newspapers. It's a very major issue in this country right now. But you know, when you see this, or when you talk directly with the people who've been in the prisons, you realize that it's. I think it's the kind of thing that we've got to raise. You know, people have got to raise their voices about. And the other thing is that people have started to raise their voices. You know, once the one person, you know, one courageous person, raises his voice, then. You know, the next guy takes a little bit less courage, but he's still got to be courageous, but then he can come out and do it. And this is what's happened. You know,
do you see an increasing confrontation over these kinds of issues? President Chu has made some very strong statements recently about, I believe, well, calling out the army to deal with the students and that sort of thing. Is that just rhetoric, or do you think that that there really is some really large confrontation?
In the past, when Mr. Teo has used this rhetoric or these words, he has backed them up by more repressive measures. A specific example was that he began the whole case against Deputy Trung Ngoc Cho by in Vung Tau saying that the army and the people will cut off their heads, referring to them as dogs and this sort of thing. After he made that statement, he took a very determined and, I think, foolish path, but he stuck by it all the way. I think it is a danger sign, you know, that the students are very afraid of this. They see this, they're predicting greater repression, but they're also saying that, you know, you've got to work to bring an end. That being afraid is not going to solve it.
These kinds of tortures and jailings of students and political opponents of the Chu regime occur every day in Vietnam. They will continue even if the South Vietnamese government cleans up the Con Sun tiger cages because of public pressure in the United States. The tortures and jailings will continue to occur in police stations throughout Vietnam. When asked about American knowledge and participation in these atrocities, the U.S. Embassy in Saigon told Pacifica Radio, quote, "The control of this prison system rests with the Ministry of Interior of the Vietnamese government," unquote. It is just a further sign of the bankruptcy of the American effort in Vietnam that in a country where the American government controls the economy, the military operation of the war, and even the political composition of the government, that the United States can say it has no control over Vietnamese affairs. The real story, of course, is that the American government chooses not to intervene in matters of vital interest to South Vietnamese as a people, but only in matters which will assure the political survival of it.
It's now 52 minutes after 5 o'clock. Here with a commentary is Conrad Lin.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Would you be seated, please? Mr. Cormier.
Are any of the difficulties that the South Vietnamese Army have encountered in Laos in recent weeks going to cause you to slow down the rate of American troop withdrawal?
No, as a matter of fact, what has already been accomplished in Laos at this time has ensured even more the plan for withdrawal of American troops. I will make another announcement in April, as I have previously indicated, and the disruption of the supply lines of the enemy through Laos, which has now occurred for 3 weeks, has very seriously damaged the enemy's ability to wage effective action against our remaining forces in Vietnam, and assures even more the success of our troop withdrawal program. One other point that has been assured, I just had a report from General Abrams today with regard to the performance of the South Vietnamese. You ladies and gentlemen will recall that at the time of Cambodia, I pointed out that the South Vietnamese army had come of age. But then they were fighting side by side with American ground forces. Now in southern Laos and also in Cambodia, the South Vietnamese on the ground by themselves are taking on the very best units that the North Vietnamese can put in the field. General Abrams tells me that in both Laos and in Cambodia, his evaluation after 3 weeks of fighting is that, to use his terms, the South Vietnamese by themselves can hack it, and they can give a better account of themselves even than the North Vietnamese units. This means that our withdrawal program, our Vietnamization program, is a success and can continue on schedule, and we trust even ahead of schedule, assuming that there is more progress in Laos.
Mr. President, this is a question that you addressed yourself to at your last news conference, but I'd like to ask it again in view of the fact that President Chu has publicly said several times, publicly raised the possibility of South Vietnamese forces invading North Vietnam. Would the United States support such an invasion of North Vietnam by the South Vietnamese?
Well, Mr. Richer, I think it is important to restate the answer that I gave at the last news conference, because you'll recall that was in the office where only you ladies and gentlemen who regularly cover the White House were present, and the television audience did not hear the answer. To restate it completely, let me break it down into its component parts. First, the question is, what will President Chu in South Vietnam do? The second question is, what will the United States do? And third, what might we do together? Now, on the first question, President Chu has stated that he would consider the necessity of invading North Vietnam. Let's look at his position. There are no South Vietnamese in North Vietnam. There are 100,000 North Vietnamese in South Vietnam, and they've already killed over 200,000 South Vietnamese. Therefore, President Chu has to take the position that unless the North Vietnamese leave South Vietnam alone, he has to consider the possibility of going against the North. That is his position, and I'm not going to speculate on what position he might take in the future in order to defend himself, the right of self-defense, in view of the fact that he is being attacked. He is not attacking North Vietnam. The second part of the question deals with what we will do. And there, as you will recall, I stated that American policy is that we will have no ground forces in North Vietnam, in Cambodia, or in Laos, except, of course, for rescue teams which go in for American flyers or for prisoners of war, where we think there is an opportunity in that case. On the other hand, I have stated on 10 different occasions, usually in before press conferences in which you ladies and gentlemen have participated, that in two respects we would use air power against the North. One, that we would attack those missile sites that fired at our planes. And we have been doing that. We will continue to do that. Second, that if I determined that increased infiltration from North Vietnam endangered our remaining forces in South Vietnam at a time we were withdrawing, that I would order attacks on the supply routes, on the infiltration routes, on the military complexes. And I have done that in the past, and I shall do so again if I determine that such activities by North Vietnam may endanger our remaining forces in South Vietnam, particularly as we are withdrawing. Now, the third question is this one: whether or not the United States, through its air power, might support a South Vietnamese operation against North Vietnam. And the answer to that is that no such plan is under consideration in this government.
Mr. President, on the
subject of enemy missiles, the North Vietnamese seem to be using more and perhaps a different type of missile, shooting at American planes supporting the lawless operation. I'm wondering if this is of unusual alarm to you, and if you have any special retaliation other than bombing that you intend to take.
We're following that very closely, and it is not unusually alarming. We expect the enemy to improve its capabilities just as we improve ours. And we are prepared to take the protective reaction measures which will deal very effectively with it. But I can say it will not be tit for tat. Mr. Harner.
In view of recent remarks by Senators Symington and Fulbright, can you define for us the roles and the relative influence in the formulation of foreign policy of Secretary of State Rogers and of Dr. Kissinger?
Well, Mr. Harner, you've been around Washington even a little longer than I have, and as I'm sure you will agree, this game of trying to divide the president from his Secretary of State or to create a conflict between the Secretary of State and whoever happens to be the president's advisor for national security affairs has been going on for as long as I can remember, and I understand it's been on long before I got here. I think that Senator Symington's attack upon the secretary, frankly, was a cheap shot. I say that not in condemnation of him for making this statement, but I say it only because he knows the relationship between Secretary Rogers and me. He knows that Secretary Rogers is my oldest and closest friend in the cabinet. I've known him for 24 years. I not only respect his ability and take his advice in the field of foreign policy, I also ask his advice and often take it in many domestic concerns as well. He is the foreign policy advisor for the president. He is the chief foreign policy spokesman for the president. He participates in every decision that is made by the President of the United States. He will continue to participate in those decisions. Now, the role of Dr. Kissinger is a different one. He is the White House advisor to the president. He covers not only foreign policy, but national security policy, the coordination of those policies. He also gives me advice, just as Secretary Laird gives me advice in matters of defense. I would say that I respect his advice as well. As to whether either Secretary Rogers or Dr. Kissinger is the top advisor, as to who is on first, the answer to that, of course, is very simply that the Secretary of State is always the chief foreign policy advisor and the chief foreign policy spokesman of the administration. At the same time, the assistant to the president for national security affairs does advise the president, and I value his advice very much.
Mr. President, there is some feeling in this city and perhaps around the country that you are trying to prepare the American people for the possibility that between 50,000 and 100,000 American troops will still have to be in South Vietnam by election time next year. Is that true?
I really can't tell you what the feeling is in this city. I can tell you what my own plans are. We are for a total withdrawal of all American forces on a mutual basis. As far as those forces are concerned, I have stated in this press conference that Gene Richard referred to a moment ago, I have stated, however, that as long as there are American POWs and there are 1,600 Americans in North Vietnam jail under very difficult circumstances at the present time, as long as there are American POWs in North Vietnam, we will have to maintain a residual force in South Vietnam. That is the least that we can negotiate for. As far as our goal is concerned, our goal is to get the all Americans out of Vietnam as soon as we can, by negotiation if possible, and through our withdrawal program and Vietnamization program if necessary. Now, as to when we will have them out, I will make the announcements in due time. I have another one coming in April. I will be making other announcements, and I think the record will be a pretty good one when we conclude it.
Mr. Bailey. Sir, in speaking of the potentialities of action against North Vietnam, and you were talking on the third point about the possibility of American air support for a South Vietnamese attack. You said that no such plan is under consideration in this government. Can you go any further than that, or is that all you wish to say about it?
Mr. Bailey, I can say further that no such plan has ever been suggested by President Chu to us. None has been considered, and none is under consideration. I'm not going to go further than that, except to state what I did state in that press conference where you also were present. Again, that the test as to what the United States will do in North Vietnam in any event will always be not what happens to forces of South Vietnam, but it will be whether or not the President, as Commander-in-Chief, considers that North Vietnamese activities are endangering or may endanger the American forces as we continue to withdraw. It is then and only then that I will use air power against military complexes on the borders of North Vietnam.
President, Mr. President, sir, if all of the North Vietnamese troops were to be withdrawn from South Vietnam, would we still insist that American troops could not be withdrawn until North Vietnamese troops also left Cambodia and Laos?
The proposal we have made, Mr. Tahoris, is, of course, for a Southeast Asia settlement, one in which the North Vietnamese troops, there are 40,000 approximately, as you know, in Cambodia. There are now approximately, by latest estimate, 90,000 to 100,000 in Laos. And, of course, there are 100,000 or so in South Vietnam. It is a one-package situation. As far as we are concerned, that is the proposal, and that is the one that we will stick by in Paris.
In your foreign policy report, you invited better relations with Communist China, which is being interpreted in Taiwan, I believe, with a little bit of apprehension. Are you actually moving toward a two-China policy?
I understand the apprehension in Taiwan, but I believe that that apprehension, insofar as Taiwan's continued existence and as its continued membership in the United Nations, is not justified. You will also have noted that in my foreign policy report, I said that we stood by our defense commitments to Taiwan, that Taiwan, which has a larger population than two-thirds of all of the United Nations, could not and would not be expelled from the United Nations as long as we had anything to say about it. And that as far as our attitude toward the Communist China was concerned, that would be governed by Communist China's attitude toward us. In other words, we would like to normalize relations with all nations in the world. There has, however, been no receptivity on the part of Communist China. But under no circumstances will we proceed with a policy of normalizing relations with Communist China if the cost of that policy is to expel Taiwan from the family of nations.
Mr. Lisagor.
You said also in your foreign policy report that even if the North Vietnamese negotiate seriously at Paris, there will be serious problems left in Laos and Cambodia, and that on the battlefield there would be some hard options to be made about deploying Allied troops. Could you clarify those statements? Because it suggests that we're going to be there a much longer time than your earlier answer did.
Well, Mr. Lisagor, our goal is a complete American withdrawal from Cambodia, Laos, and South Vietnam. As you know, that is the proposal I made on October 7th. I made it, however, on a mutual basis, that we would withdraw, but that the North Vietnamese would withdraw at the same time. Now, as to what happens after we withdraw, we cannot guarantee that North and South Vietnam will not continue to be enemies. We cannot guarantee that there will not continue to be some kind of guerrilla activities in Laos or even in Cambodia. As far as our own goal is concerned, our proposal is clear, and we ask the enemy to consider it, a mutual withdrawal of forces, our forces and theirs. If that happens, we will be glad to withdraw, and then these other nations will have to see whether or not they can handle their own affairs. Mr. Tice.
Matter. Do you see any limit on the exercise of executive privilege?
The matter of executive privilege is one that it always depends on which side you're on. I well recall, and Mr. Tice, you were covering me at the time when I was a member of the House, that I raised serious questions of as a member of an investigating committee about the executive privilege that was, at that time, looking back in retrospect, properly insisted upon by President Truman. And as president, I believe that executive privilege is essential for the orderly processes of government. Now, let me just point out, however, what it does not cover. I was very surprised to note the suggestion that the Secretary of State was not available enough for testimony. I checked it out. Over the past 2 years, State Department officials have testified 499 times before the House and the Senate. The Secretary of State himself has testified personally 14 times in 1969 and 15 times in 1970. He has had 167 private meetings, in addition to all that, with individual senators or in groups of senators at the State Department or at his home. As a matter of fact, I don't know how he's had time to talk to me with all the time he's talking to the Congress.
Mr. President, you have said earlier that there will have to be a residual force staying in South Vietnam as long as the North Vietnamese continue to hold prisoners. You've also said on previous occasions that you will not hesitate to take any strong action in order to protect whatever troops remain in South Vietnam, whatever of our troops remain in South Vietnam. Does this in effect mean that despite your Vietnamization plan, that you will have to have, in a sense, an indefinite commitment to South Vietnam with troops there indefinitely, determined only by Hanoi and their actions?
I would suggest that you, ladies and gentlemen, always pretty much underestimated what I am capable of doing in terms of withdrawing forces and so forth. Let me just put it all in perspective as I can. We've had a great deal of discussion about Laos at the last press conference, and I can see that it's still an interest here. And the question of Cambodia still troubles many of you. I recall at the time that we went into Cambodia, and all of you out there looking on television and will remember what I said. I said the purpose of our going into Cambodia was to cut American casualties and to ensure the success of our withdrawal program. Many of the members of the press disagreed with me. They thought that was not an accurate description of what would happen. They were entitled to that view. Night after night, after I announced the decision to go into Cambodia on television, it was indicated that that decision would have the opposite effect, that it would increase American casualties, and that it would mean that it would prolong the war. Now, we can look at it in retrospect. Casualties are one half of what they were before Cambodia, and our withdrawal program has continued, and actually, we were able to step it up some during the last of 1970. Now, in Laos, the purpose of the Laotian operation was the same as that of the Cambodian operation. This time, no American ground forces, only American air power. I said then, and I repeat now, the purpose is not to expand the war into Laos. The purpose is to save American lives, to guarantee the continued withdrawal of our own forces, and to increase the ability of the South Vietnamese to defend themselves without our help, which means, of course, their ability to help our Vietnamization program and our own withdrawal program. Now, I realize that night after night for the past 3 weeks on television, there is a drumbeat of suggestion, not from all, but from some commentators, and I can understand why they disagree. From the same ones who said that Cambodia wouldn't work, that this isn't going to work. Well, I have analyzed the thing very carefully when I made the decision. I have had reports all day today from General Abrams, and speaking today, I can say there's some hard fighting ahead. But the decision to go into Laos, I think, was the right decision. It will reduce American casualties. The 200,000 rounds of ammunition, the 2,000 heavy and light guns that have already been captured and destroyed, the 67 tanks that have been destroyed, are not going to be killing Americans. And, most significant, I checked the flow of supplies down the trails from the area in which the North Vietnamese and the South Vietnamese are engaged.